This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A Northern Kentucky city faces a lawsuit after two female officers say they faced discrimination at the hands of the chief. Meanwhile, officers across the nation accused of misconduct are now part of a searchable database. We'll talk about those stories and more just ahead on the Friday News Review. But first,
where's the heart? Where's the fairness? Mm-hmm. I don't want to move where I live at. I feel safe where I'm at. I got stuff over my windows. We got a security door.
A lot of them are handicapped and older. A move could kill them. They can't afford a move. So if they are going to move against their will, then they need to be compensated properly.
But for those who haven't found a place to be by the end of this month, we will extend their opportunity to be able to find a place to land.
That was West End resident Ken Rhodes, Seven Hills Neighborhood House's community engagement coordinator Tia Brown, and former Cincinnati mayor and current FC Cincinnati director of community development Mark Mallory. All of them spoke on Monday during another meeting about the FC Cincinnati soccer stadium. Let's discuss the latest. We've got WCPO news anchor and reporter Evan Millward, who joins us on the phone. Welcome, Evan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman is here. Welcome back, Jay.
Hi there.
If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some in the show today. So we're a sports team, not residential property managers. That's what FC president and general manager Jeff Birding had to say at a news conference on Thursday. Evan, what happened at that news conference?
Well, you know, that news conference was mainly to respond to a motion by the city that basically said, if you don't move the residents from 421 Wade Street into the other building you own at 1559 Central Avenue, we may not approve your rezoning request. And what you ended up hearing Jeff Birding say at that news conference is that may not be legal for you to tell us to do that. And we're not going to do it. No one wins here, I think, is kind of the sense I got yesterday, is that the team, Jeff Birding's not wrong. They are a soccer club. They are not in the business of being landlords. However, the minute you buy property in which people live, you are in the business of being a landlord. And this is not, like I said, no one really wins here. The optics of this are bad for all parties involved, I think.
And Jay, we seem to talk about this stadium every Friday. So where exactly in the midst of this battle now, where do we stand with all of it?
Well, let's fill in a little background. Part of the reason that this is an issue for some city council members is Jeff Birding, in previous interviews, broadcast and print alike, when this process was unfolding, for city council to approve the initial funding for the FC Cincinnati Stadium, said that there would be no residents displaced by the stadium. And subsequent to him making those statements, he pointed that out yesterday in the news conference, that he was talking about the initial footprint of the stadium, which was true, that there was be no displacement. After they had the footprint, the owner of 421 Wade Street and 1559 Central Avenue had some offers from what Jeff Birding called speculators. And his name is Mr. Berger, and he came to FC Cincinnati and said, would you like to buy these buildings? And FC Cincinnati said yes, because they're trying to protect what goes in around their stadium. Now, Mr. Birding said that he wasn't sure that he didn't realize that these buildings had residents in them. That might be a little hard to believe since they clearly look like apartment buildings. But nonetheless, they bought those, they became landlords, and they essentially told these residents that they had to be out by April the 30th. This is where council comes in and says, FC needs this zoning change. You said no one would be displaced. So if you want us to vote for the zoning change, let the residents who are in 421 go to 1559 Central Avenue. And Mr. Birding said yesterday that, you know, they're not landlords. They have other plans for these buildings. They're happy to find accommodations for these residents, but they cannot stay in these buildings.
Okay. How did the vote at City Hall go?
It was 5-2. And basically the motion said, you either take this solution, come up with another solution, but let the residents who are in the 421 Wade Street building go to 1559 Central Avenue.
Evan, we heard concerns repeatedly from those residents nearby as construction work continues there at the stadium site near our studios here in the West End. Is there any indication that progress is being made to alleviate the concerns of those residents?
From the folks we have talked to this week, even as recently as yesterday, and I know Josh Bazan is on this story for us today, because Mr. Birding and the club are supposed to be meeting, I think he told us yesterday, as early as today, meeting with these residents to check in. Some of these folks have been moved and have found a place, but there are plenty. I spoke to one on Tuesday who is trying to be out by the end of the month, but she's not entirely sure, and she thinks she'll have a place. She's not sure how she's going to move her stuff. There are people who are finding ways out, and the club has said, we'll make sure they find their way out. I think Jay just said that too. But I think the minute that FC Cincinnati announced it was going into the Starkville Stadium site, these people were on alert. One of the folks I talked to Tuesday said, we figured this was coming. And but then we heard no one will be displaced, so we thought we had some time.
And it's something that this neighborhood knows well in terms of developments coming in and reshaping that neighborhood, so there must be some history that motivates their concerns.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I-75 pretty much eliminating the Kenyon Barr neighborhood. You could argue the West End has been maybe the most tinkered with neighborhood in the city of Cincinnati in history, given developments coming in and moving people, displacing people, or for lack of a better phrase, screwing with quality of life for people there. It dates back 60 years or more.
I want to read the full quote from Jeff Birding, the FC Cincinnati president and general manager. We have no desire to be Section 8 landlords. We will not be Section 8 landlords. We are a soccer team. And again, for council to say we are going to require you to become Section 8 landlord in order to get a zoning approval that doesn't even involve any of these buildings in question is outside the law. So Jay and Evan, feel free to weigh in afterwards. What are we to make of the relationship now between this sports team, this Major League Soccer team, and the city government?
That's a good question. everyone counts it as, I think, there's a clear majority, which would be five members. Maybe I back that down to four members. Who think this is a positive economic development for the city, and they're happy to be in the MLS. But I think there's going to be some growing pains as we, address these little issues of getting things, the final necessary approvals for this project to move forward. One thing the team did do, now originally it's complicated in zoning, but they're setting up a planned development. Originally they wanted to add the Wade Street and I believe the Central Avenue to that PD. They have backed off of that. So basically the only thing that council needs to approve as far as a zoning change are basically they abandoned three rights of way. One of them is on Central Avenue near Wade Street. Another one's on 15th Street. And it looks like there's a little alley next to that. Those three need to be approved for what Mr. Birding says is for the stadium to move forward. The fight about what becomes of these eventual Wade Street and Central Avenue buildings will come later.
Evan, I'm curious if for some reason perhaps FC Cincinnati feels like it's being treated differently by local government than its friends closer to the riverfront in Paul Brown Stadium and Great American Ballpark. I mean, we have a long history around here of constructing stadia with different, controversy surrounding them. But I don't know if there has been more controversy around stadium development than what we're seeing now in a lot of different areas related to development. So what are you getting in terms of the sense that FC Cincinnati may feel like it's the redheaded stepchild of our professional sports teams?
I think there's no one better qualified to navigate this than Jeff Birding. He's got the history of knowing how to handle it as someone who was on city council and then someone who was involved with the Paul Brown Stadium negotiations and that deal. And Jay mentioned this, so you find it a little hard to believe that he didn't see some of this coming. But in previously, long before these issues that we've been dealing with this week, I talked to Jeff Birding, and the sense I get is that when it comes to these sorts of things, it's a little bit like a hot dog in the sense that you want to enjoy the finished product, and you really don't want to see how it's made.
And are they serving hot dogs at this stadium?
I'm sure they will be. But it's when you're building in what is traditionally a residential neighborhood, you're going to run into these things. And one of the things Jay mentioned is this rezoning. I think this is so important. This rezoning request has been scaled back so much that it doesn't even involve the buildings that we're kind of, the city is kind of fighting over at the moment. And Tuesday when PG Sittenfeld and David Mann announced this motion, I asked them about if it has any teeth, because at the end of the day, the club owns these buildings and their rights as landlords, whether they want to be a landlord or not, they are. Their rights as landlords are that they can tell these folks that they have 30 days to be out. My understanding is the previous owner had given them 70 days notice. So the club has an opportunity here that is quickly fleeting. The club has an opportunity to live up to these promises that Jeff Berning and Mark Mallory have made, that they want to be good neighbors in the West End and they want to do right by the West End and they want to be this catalyst for positive change in the West End. They have a fleeting opportunity here to prove it. I always say I worked for 3 years in Missouri, so I have adopted the show me mentality. If you want to do this, show me. And they have a chance to do it. I think the choice of wording yesterday of we're not Section 8 landlords was not a great look for the club. It's not wrong, but that rubs a lot of people in the West End who already are not real pleased with things the wrong way. But they have a chance if they can get these people into equivalent or better housing, and if they can win over these people at the end of the day, the people that they are displacing, they will have won, I think, public opinion here. They have a great opportunity to do this.
Jay, I think the point that Evan's raising here is that has the rhetoric elevated a notch from the sports side of things in this conversation?
Oh, I think definitely so. And the thing is, we're actually fighting over a zoning approval that still is yet to come before council. The process, they had a staff hearing. The Planning Commission is going to hold a special meeting on May the 10th to approve it. Only after it's approved by the Planning Commission will it come to City Council for approval, which is expected the week after that. But, you know, on if you were to look on council's agenda for a rezoning item related to FC Cincinnati today, you're not going to find it in the system because it doesn't exist yet.
513-419-7100 is the number to call. Let's go to the phones. We've got David on the line. Hey, David.
Good afternoon. I'm afraid that I see with a very cynical view what's happening here. It's a long history, and it was alluded to earlier, that when the wealthy business interests in Cincinnati see an opportunity to make more money, especially at the expense of poor black communities, the poor black communities who have no political power are completely run roughshod. We saw that in I-75, as was alluded to earlier. And this never should have happened without the participation of the neighborhood before that neighborhood was wiped out.
David, we appreciate the call and the comment. And I guess it's important to note also, and thanks to our producer, Selena, for reminding me to mention this, that when I referenced the stadia on the riverfront, that they didn't really impact residents so much as this one is. So that certainly weighs into the level of controversy.
But FCC would also want you to know that the public is not paying for its stadiums as it did the two stadiums that are the stadia that are on the riverfront.
WCPO News anchor and reporter Evan Millward, we appreciate you taking some time to chat with us today, Evan.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And Jay, let's continue now with another frequent topic of discussion on the Jay Hanselman Friday show. Columbia Parkway, which incidentally happened to be closed again today due to mudslides this morning. If you've got questions about Columbia Parkway, give us a call, 513-419-7100, while we still have Jay here. What happened today?
Another landslide. Anytime there's a heavy rain, as is often the case anymore, there's I don't want to say that they're huge landslides, but there are, you know, debris and mud that come over the retaining walls along Columbia Parkway. It was enough. Originally, they shut down the inbound lanes, and as soon as they had crews, they shut down Columbia Parkway altogether because of those landslides.
So this is so frequent. And City Hall now seems to recognize some urgency with the situation. They had a very long meeting this week, I believe you got to attend. So it looks like council decided to favor repairs to the parkway over a new police station. Tell us what happened with that vote.
Well, they needed several weeks ago, they had announced that it was going to take $17 million to make repairs to stop these landslides between Baines and Torrance along Columbia Parkway. And it was a matter of where do we come up with the $17 million to do that. The city manager had one proposal that essentially borrowed about $9, $10 million. And then they were going to take $6.2 million in cash that had been set aside for District 5 and use that on Columbia Parkway. There was some disagreement among council members. They weren't necessarily in favor of taking the cash from District 5 and sending it to Columbia Parkway. And originally, I thought that was because we want to make sure that District 5 gets done. Turns out they were more concerned about where District 5 may end up, because there was about $9.4 million in this cash fund for District 5. The manager was still going to use $3.2 million of that to remodel, to make some improvements to the temporary location for District 5 in College Hill. And council members were concerned that if they spent that $3.5 million to make these repairs, then College Hill essentially could become the permanent home to District 5. And there's been public opinion pretty strong on both sides. They went through a very public process, narrowed it down to two sites, Clifton or College Hill, and they were afraid that if they spent that $3.2 million on the temporary location, they were kind of putting their thumb on the scale that, okay, District 5 is going to remain in College Hill. So in the end, rather than just 6.2 for the parkway, keep 3.2 for temporary improvements, they took all of the District 5 cash, sent it to Columbia Parkway, and then that means that there's less borrowing they have to do to complete that project.
So what does that mean for District 5? Does it just hang out in College Hill for now?
It can hang out in College Hill. They have a temporary occupancy permit for they're basically like in a strip shopping center, and they only have that occupancy permit through June of 2021. So between now and a couple of years from now, they're going to have to figure out, do we make this work permanently? Do we move to Clifton? There's also a motion floating around that perhaps we'll combine District 1, which is located next to the FCC Stadium. See, we can tie those two together too, throw in Columbia Parkway. And then District 5 and put them in one building on Central Parkway near where the old Permit Center used to be.
So can you break down the vote for us? I understand there were some divisions that led up to a unanimous vote.
Well, the first plan was the city administration plan to use $6.2 million from District 5 money. That tied 4-4, a tie vote in council fails, and the mayor is not able to break a tie. So the backup plan was to borrow $6.2 million, preserve the District 5 money. That tied 4-4. And so they essentially took a long recess and made some negotiations and came back and decided that they would use all the District 5 cash, and that would pass unanimously 8-0. Councilmember Silbach was excused from voting this week because he was out of town.
Were those the same 4-4 votes, same people on both mm-hmm. sides of those issues?
Yeah.
Okay, so you reported that construction will start in June.
That's the plan.
Okay.
They have to negotiate the contracts in the month of May. If that all goes well, then the actual construction would start sometime in June.
I mean, this is a major road. you just can't really overstate that. It's a major road. You're saying that this construction could last 18 months to 2 years.
18 months is the best case scenario. They're hoping 2 years is the worst case scenario, but it will be a lengthy project. During that time, there are going to be lane closures. And they're going to try to perhaps work that so that there are more lanes inbound in the morning, more lanes outbound in the afternoon. But there will be restrictions, and at sometimes probably maybe even on the weekends, the parkway may be completely shut down while they do this work.
How is it going to be repaired technically?
I'm going to give you the Jay's simple explanation.
Well, good, because that's the only one I'm going to understand.
Basically, in some places, they're going to build a new retaining wall above the current retaining walls. And in other places, they're going to do what's called soil nailing. And basically, that's like driving a huge nail down into the bedrock underneath the earth. And then they will put like netting on top of that, basically, to hold the soil and the land back.
Soil nailing. Sounds like the next YouTube trend or something that we want to watch out for kids.
Before we get complaints, it's way more complicated than that.
It sounds like it
but
is.
I'm trying to make it as simple as possible.
We apologize to all the engineers listening and frankly, to the people who are driving. We hope we have some more details at WVXU.org for you. And what type of traffic situation should we expect while this is going on? You said there's going to be lanes open, but is this going to be a headache? Are people going to want alternate routes?
They will probably have to find alternate routes. They're also talking about, you'll recall maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, they installed bicycle lanes on Riverside Drive that took it from four travel lanes to 2 travel lanes. They're talking about that maybe temporarily they might have to adjust some of that so they can make it as basically like a relief valve to some of the traffic that won't be able to use the parkway to be able to use Riverside Drive. But if you're like me and drive 471 into town, out of town in the morning and afternoon, the next 18 to 24 months, your route's probably going to be just a little bit more crowded.
We're going to have your good buddy Bill Reinhart coming up, and he's going to be talking about hotels, so we're going to see how well he does with the word occupancy. City Hall reporter,
said it wrong once.
WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman, thanks for chatting with us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Up next, why there is now a searchable national database for police officers accused of misconduct, plus a Northern Kentucky city sued over sexual discrimination allegations in the police department, and later, a new app developed locally to help you track cicadas when they return. This is the Friday News Review on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. A long effort by reporters across the country led to the creation of a national searchable database for police officers accused of misconduct. The Friday News Review continues now with Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher. Welcome back, James.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Questions or comments on this, call us 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on social media. James, this was a national effort by the USA Today Network, of which you were a part. The Cincinnati Inquirer was a part of that network. So in terms of just the numbers, what did you find out about police misconduct?
Well, we found we have been working on this for more than a year, and we've only scratched the surface. So we've collected data on police misconduct through finding internal affairs files and all of those kinds of things from about 700 departments around the country. Now, keep in mind, there's a total of 18,000 departments in this whole country, so we've only hit less than 10%. But in those, we found 80,000 officers who were accused of misconduct. Several of which, thousands of which had actually been accused of more than one event. That included 200,000 different incidents.
You said 80,000.
80,000.
Officers. Individuals.
Yeah. And then what we published, the database, what we published is a list of about 30,000 officers who are what's called decertified, which means they basically lost their license to be a police officer in that particular state. So, and we only got data from 44 states. Some states like California and Massachusetts don't even decertify their officers if there's something bad happens. So like I said, that data only includes 44 states, but it's searchable by name, by state, whatever. In that list of the 30,000, decertified officers, about 10% were for drug or alcohol abuse, but another 10% were for some kind of domestic abuse or, child abuse. And then there were a good 2,200 officers who actually were expelled or decertified for lying or perjury or tampering with evidence. So again, this is we're just getting started. We're not just getting started. We've been going on this for, like I said, more than a year, but we're now starting to publish this. We're going to have a series of stories coming out.
So was this misconduct alleged? Was it verified? Were all of these convictions?
No. So the overall numbers of the 80,000 were just investigations. Again, to look at that versus the 30,000, which those were actual hard, they lost their license to be a cop, basically in that state. Now, the interesting thing about that is that in some cases, those officers were able to go to other states because the state rules are so different, and they were able to become an officer in another state even though they've been decertified in their original state. So, you know, there's a lot of moving around. It's kind of like, you know, we've seen these kinds of stories about bad teachers moving around from state to state, or doctors or things like that. It's the same thing with police officers, and that the different states have different standards and different levels of scrutiny. And the other thing we found is that, and this was highlighted in the story about the police chiefs, was some of these areas, rural areas, little towns, everything else, are so hard up. There's a police shortage in this country. They're so hard up that they don't look very hard at the backgrounds of some of these guys, or, you know, they take what they can get. And some of these jobs are 20 hours a week for $15 an hour with no health care. So they're cobbling together these careers of different police departments.
So we've had a conversation or situations and news coverage in this country for years now involving policing and shootings of unarmed black men, the protests that that ensued, the NFL players kneeling controversy, just so many angles to the situation of policing in certain communities in this country. What does a report like this do to or for that national conversation?
I think I just think it enlightens it or it informs it better because – you know, without having hard numbers, we don't know the scope of the possible problem. Now, that 80,000 is less than 10% of all the police that were covered by our investigation, right? Or all the different of the size of the force. But in there were thousands of officers who had been investigated multiple times, including some that had hundreds of different allegations against them. So, and yet they were able to, and I think what this is also going to help inform us is shine a light on the discipline process and how when a cop does something, allegedly does something wrong, what happens after that? And the rules and the laws and the rules and the union negotiations have been put in place to help protect those officers. Maybe gets a second look.
How varied are the laws across the country?
Oh my gosh, that was a big part of my research early on in this project last year, and I can tell you it goes everything from really strict to, you know, if you get fired, you basically lose your license, to basically, oh, we'll just review it if somebody brings it to our attention. And like I said, California, which has the most police officers of anywhere in the country, they don't have any rules for certifying or decertifying. It's up to the individual departments to do what they want with discipline. So it's so individualized, localized, balkanized that it's you know, it's all over the map. And I think that's one of the things that's starting to come to light about all this.
What can you tell us about those regulations in terms of requirements for police officers locally?
Okay, locally in Ohio, you know, you have to go through a certain level of training. You can't have a felony on your record, even misdemeanor convictions for drug abuse or perjury or domestic abuse or anything like that. And like I said, there's pretty stringent training standards that you have to get to do continuous training or whatever. Now, in Ohio and Kentucky, if you are convicted of a felony, you're automatically disqualified. But in our case that we wrote about with the chief's story, the individual there was able to get his sentence diverted into a program and then get the record sealed because he was a first-time offender. And that enabled him to keep his certification. And then he went on. He got fired again, reinstated again by a mediator, and then somehow was able to you know, cobble together a career and actually became chief of police in a small town.
So what role do police unions play in this, because they seem to have a lot of protections for their members?
They're very big, you know, and that's another political issue. You know, I'm not going to say which side is right or wrong, but certainly politicians like to listen to the police unions. They cater to their votes. I would say that the police union here in Cincinnati is very, very strong politically. And for example, in Cincinnati, these are kind of rules that are in place. If you're disciplined, that information goes into a separate file than your personnel file. So you have to ask for that separately if you ask for their personnel file through an open records request, for example. So a lot of people don't know that. And then after I'm going to get the years wrong, but after a certain amount of time, if that officer has not had another offense, those are pulled from those files. So you know, because they cycle through. So something that happened to an officer that an officer did badly 10 years ago is not going to show up in his file because they cycle through. The rationale is that they don't want to have a predisposition for new supervisors because they rotate so much. And then lastly, if, say, I as a reporter wanted to get a personnel file of Joe Smith, the officer, the union has negotiated that that officer gets a 5-day warning period. So they wait at least 5 days to give me the report because they have to inform the officer that the media wants his personnel file. So those are the kinds of things that are in place, and they're in place in departments all over the country.
And some of these departments then will hire people who have felonies on their record?
Well, it depends. It depends by state. It depends on whether or not the felony has been sealed or people know about it. Most states, I would say the vast majority of the states prohibit anybody with a felony record from becoming an officer. But there are exceptions.
And in our workplaces, if there's a background check required, you know, maybe you use the FBI, what kind of background checks are these departments doing?
It depends. A lot of times they go straight to the state. It's called OPATA in Ohio. There's a state repository of records that for police officers that they go and do a background check on. But there's cases where the stuff gets wiped off their record, like I wrote about with this guy David Simperman up in Northeast Ohio, up in Amsterdam. All those things didn't show up on that standard background check. But if the mayor of that town had just called the police chief and where he had previously worked, the guy said, all he has to do is come look at his personnel file. And Michael, I can tell you, I've seen the personnel file. It is the size of a filing box. You know, I've got my hands 3 feet apart right now, and that's how big it was. It was full of all his different transgressions.
So he was able to pass a background check, but would have failed a simple reference check, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, because the police chief is prohibited from, like, saying, oh, he's a bad guy. But he said, all I have to do is call me and I say, look, you need to come look at his personnel file. And then when they do, then that's it. But he says nobody calls him.
Why this story? Why did the USA Today Network pursue this?
Well, like you were saying, this particular time in history right now, we're dealing with all kinds of questions about police conduct and policing tactics and policing in general. And like I said, we wanted to get our arms around the scope of the issues and the scope of the problem. So maybe inform the debate a little bit more.
Thanks to Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher for joining us, Dave.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A northern Kentucky city faces a lawsuit over alleged discrimination against female officers in the police department. The Friday News Review continues now with Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter Max Lonberg, who joins us on the phone. Welcome back, Max.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
Anyone with questions or comments about what we talk about with Max today, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org. So, Max, the northern Kentucky city facing this lawsuit is Taylor Mill. It's a relatively small Kenton County city south of most of Covington. What's the story here?
So the lawsuit claims that these women both were passed over for promotions for men, although the lawsuit says they were more experienced than the men who were chosen for these sergeant and lieutenant positions. One woman is Karen Spanier. She was hired by the department in 1996. She had a 2-year gap where she went to a different job, came back, and then was up for a lieutenant or applied for a lieutenant position, but was passed over for a man who had less overall experience in the department. And then for the other woman, Heather Mitchell, she had 18 years of experience in the department, but was a man was promoted to sergeant over her after he had returned to the department 4 months earlier.
So neither of these women are currently with the police department now.
I believe... Spanier retired last November, if I remember right. She is not, but I believe Mitchell is still with the department.
Okay, so you have one active officer on the department that has filed this lawsuit. So has that impacted whether she reports to work? How does this situation work?
To be honest, I haven't spoken with her in an attempt to reach the department was unsuccessful. They said they can't comment on ongoing litigation.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that, whether the city of Taylor Mill had released any statements. I know they hadn't earlier, but they still haven't spoken on this?
Still haven't spoken on it. Just heard back from them this morning. And, ongoing litigation, said they can't say anything.
What are these two female officers, and I mean, they're police officers, but they're suing over sexual mm-hmm. discrimination, so I'll identify them as female officers. What is it that they seek in terms of damages?
The lawsuit doesn't indicate what they're seeking, monetary figure, but they are seeking damages for lost opportunity and wages, as well as punitive damages against the department. And they are asking for a trial by jury.
Yeah, they want to go in front of a jury. We'll continue to follow that. You had a couple of other stories I hope we can talk about today. You reported recently on the Westchester woman whose killer was sentenced to more than 17 years behind bars. Tell us about this tragic case.
Right. So Michael Strauss was sentenced last week. He pleaded guilty to stalking and murdering a Westchester woman, Ellen Weick. He pleaded guilty last month. He, in the indictment, he was charged with stalking her over an 8-month period. She went by Ellie, reported in April to the Westchester Police Department that she was receiving these messages that were masked, so she couldn't identify the sender. But one message included a video of her in her home, taken from outside her home.
Oh.
So this unknown person was stalking her, essentially. She reported in April. Police, according to friends, told her to lock her doors, take a self-defense class, which she did. And Ellie, in messages to friends that we obtained, she said, "The police didn't make me feel any safer." That's a quote. They didn't make me feel any safer. So we tried to look into this issue of stalking, to see if it was perhaps a systemic problem within this department. And what we found, there were 87 reports received by the police department, stalking reports received over a 5-year period. And of those, the police department arrested 13 adults, 2 juveniles, but only obtained, through the prosecutor's office, only obtained 4 convictions for stalking. Most of the arrests, the charges were either modified, dismissed, or in one case, a defendant fled the area. So 4 convictions over 87 stalking reports is what we found.
So what has the police department said about the criticism of how it handled the Weick investigation?
I met with a lieutenant who was gracious enough to give an interview, but this was before the sentencing, and for some of the more specific details, questions that I asked about the Weick case, he wasn't able to respond, he said, because of the pending sentencing. For example, we asked if the police department had analyzed Ellie's phone, but he said he couldn't comment on that yet, although her mother did say that they granted the department access to their phone records, and she said the police did what they could, but because of the technology and the way you can mask messages, it was difficult to identify this person who was stalking Ellie.
Weick's father addressed his daughter's killer in court. What did he say?
He, like Ellie's mother and like Ellie's sister, asked the judge to sentence Strauss to the maximum, which the judge did, the maximum allowed by statute. The father, if I remember right, said, invoked forgiveness in God and said, "God asked me to forgive, but he doesn't say when." And I think Ellie's father said, I may never get there in terms of forgiving Michael Strauss.
The sentence was 70 years?
17.
It was 17, okay.
17 and a half, yes.
17 and a half was the maximum sentence?
So, yes, the specific murder charge he was facing is 15 to life, and then there were added time tacked on for stalking and for gross abuse of a corpse. So he will be eligible for parole in about 17 years with good time time already served. But if he's not granted parole, he may be, you know, he'll be in prison for years more.
And then the Cincinnati Police Department has two officers facing suspension over using the N-word. What happened?
Yes. Two separate incidents, two separate officers. One was in September. An officer was responding to a fight in Westwood as he was arresting one of the men involved. He referred to them using the N-word in a negative way that the internal investigation ruled it was in a derogatory and kind of demeaning way. The other officer in December was arresting a black woman. He directly called her the N-word, and he, according to the internal investigation, later said he didn't remember using it. But these internal investigations were concluded just recently last week, and the police chief recommended both of these officers receive 7-day suspensions, which will have to be approved by the city before it's final.
Approved by the city? What is that? Right now. Who has the approval of that?
I believe it's the city manager. I'm not certain on that, though. I just called city spokesman last night, Casey Weldon, to ask if it has been approved, but it's still going through the process of approval through the city.
Have you heard of any criticism about the proposed punishment of 7-day suspension, either from people who think there's nothing to the charges or from people who think the punishment isn't severe enough?
Well, I know when these stories broke, there were city council members calling for the termination of these officers. And on the other side of the spectrum, you have the police union president, Mr. Hills, arguing, at least in the case of Dante Hill, the officer who used the word in September, that he was initially punished with a written reprimand. And so he was punished with a written reprimand. They went back and said, no, wait a minute. We punished him for using profanity, but he should have been punished for using biased language. So they went back and basically tacked on the 7-day suspension. The police union president saying, this is double jeopardy. You can't punish him twice. So criticisms, I guess, on both sides with this 7-day suspension.
Max, your byline's been on some pretty tough stories this week. I hope you have a good weekend.
Thanks. Thank you. You too.
That's Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter Max Lonberg. We're joined now to lighten things up after all those heavy stories with... We've got WVXU reporter and All Things Considered host Bill Reinhardt. He's got cicada news to share. Thanks for being here, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So first, you did a story about the hotel boom in downtown Cincinnati. I'm sorry, had you stack your stories in the wrong order. Just, let's start with hotels.
They're just notes.
We'll keep them hanging about the cicadas.
I live downtown, and I see a lot of construction on buildings, older buildings being rehabbed, occasionally some new stuff being built. And a friend of mine, Phil Armstrong, tweeted earlier this week that a building at 5th and Walnut is going to be turned into a hotel. And I thought, wait a second, there's at least two other places. You know, 7th and Race has got two buildings there under construction as hotels. There's another one there on Walnut. How many hotels does downtown Cincinnati really need? And I'm thinking... turns out there are 7 or 8 hotels under construction in downtown Cincinnati. And is that really too many? I called Janelle Walton at the Convention and Visitors Bureau, and guess what? It's not too many, according to her. According to her, downtown had 10 hotels with just about 3,000 rooms in 2017. Now, St. Louis, about, you know, similar-sized city, had 23 downtown hotels in 2017.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, they've got a lot more. And we're going to be catching up, and having more hotel rooms gives people more options when they want to come stay, and it just kind of builds on each other. The existing hotels get that competition. They may improve some of their facilities. They may improve some of their other perks. So apparently it's a good thing to have all these buildings under construction.
I love that it was your Twitter bromance with Phil Armstrong from Cincinnati Refined that led to this very nice story that you got. Is there any concern about oversaturation? I know you said that there's room for more, but...
Yeah, no. No, she's not. Janelle is not concerned about oversaturation.
Even when you break it down to the type of hotels that are coming in.
Some of these are boutique hotels like 21C. Some are, you know, a little more mainstream traditional hotels. But yeah, they're saying bring them on, bring on even more.
How about bring on the cicadas? You had the best or maybe the worst story of the week, depending on how you feel about these little critters.
I'm taking it you're not a big fan of the cicada.
I'm not allowed to express bias on the show, including to our little tiny flying. No, they're disgusting.
Well, you've got 2 years to build up some vacation time You can just get out for about 3 weeks. When Brood 10, the Great Eastern Brood, makes its triumphant return to the tri-state, that'll be in 2021. Last time we saw that big emergence was 2004. And if you're so inclined, you can download an app now to track cicadas. It's kind of like Pokemon Go, except you don't win. You don't get points for how many cicadas you find. You just kind of contribute to the basic knowledge of science.
Oh, so it's like a network.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Gene Kritsky over at Mount St. Joe, he's developed this app with some help, and basically what they want you to do when you're going out with your cell phone, you see a cicada, you take a picture, you send it in with the app. The app sends the picture to Gene along with metadata, including the location, the time, and the date, so they can compile all that and know where the cicadas are coming out and where they are the thickest.
And people go cicada crazy when they come.
They do.
So I know that this is going to be popular. And I love in your story how Gene Kritsky from Mount St. Joe shares with you some of the older ways they used to collect it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, at the beginning, it was just go out and look around. And then they set up an answering machine. And the first time they did that,
tapes,
yeah, 1987, we all remember answering machines, don't we?
We do.
Of course, some of us still have them. Back in 87, Brood 10 emergence in Cincinnati, he says he had an answering machine with a 90-minute tape on it. The first day that the Brood 10 came out, they broke the machine in the first 3 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
So people do love and love to hate the cicadas.
And what was it this app was created because of people emailing photos or
after the answering machine, you know, kind of evolved into other things, they had people emailing photos, and you know that was great. But this app allows them to really verify where the photos are coming. If you're just getting emails, you're kind of taking it for granted. The sciences could be iffy. But with the app, it's a little more hardcore. So
the app is called Cicada Safari.
Cicada Safari. It is available now on the iTunes and the Google Play, and it is free. And Gene assures me they are not collecting any other data other than cicada.
If you're someone who says the iTunes and the Google Play, I bet you have an answering machine in your house still.
No one calls, though.
We haven't seen this brood since 2004. I had frosted tips then, so hopefully they don't recognize me when they come back.
Oh, and you're making fun of my answering machine.
Bill Reinhardt, thanks for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Find archives of our show online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.